Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Right here live, radio, everybody, on LA Talk Radio. We are so glad you're joining us. We just heard our show's special opening music, Buffalo Grass, written and performed by Rick Gilman, a personal friend of our show's founder, Jim Christina. I'm one of the show's hosts, Bobby Jean Bell. Not to worry, I am right here with Jim Christina and Richard Polinelli, our other two co-hosts. You guys just want to say hello so people know that you're with us?
We are. Yes, I am here. I am here, and I am all at Twitter. I just love talking to Joanne, so it's always special.
And Richard, you're wearing a special shirt tonight, Richard.
I have the retro 1989 LA Kings shirt on because the Kings are opening their season tonight. So guess what I'll be doing as soon as the show's over.
We had a little delay in getting started, so we're gonna get right to it.
Bobby, that's because it's live radio.
Yeah, it is.
It's not a pre-recorded
podcast. We can go back and it will be a podcast, but it's live. All righty, here we go. I speak for all three of us when I say we are excited to welcome back author J.P. McLean, who I'm going to refer to as Joanne. She writes urban fantasy and supernatural thrillers that readers describe as addictive, smart, and fun. Her work has won honorable mentions from the Whistler Independent Book Awards and the Victoria Writers Society. She makes her home in Denman Island off the coast of British Columbia. Her newest book, oh my gosh, Bloodmark, is set to release October 19th, and you will want it. And there's already a lot of excitement about it. Author E.E. Holmes has this to say about Bloodmark. Featuring a fearless, badass heroine and plot twists that will leave readers breathless, J.P. McLean's Bloodmark is gritty, sexy, fast-paced thrill ride from start to finish. Please welcome back to the Writer's Block, Joanne McLean. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction, Bobby. I appreciate that. Thanks so much. Great to be back.
Well, with you when you were with us back in April, so I'm so excited to be part of the team tonight. And I know this book isn't out yet, but it's already received a major award. Congratulations. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the Literary Titan Award, which is a gold 5-star award that I received about 2 weeks ago. So I was super excited because it's come in just under the publication date, and I'm going to get that medal up on the cover just as soon as I can. I'm very excited about it.
As well you should be.
Yeah.
As well you should be.
Well, I can just say for myself that Joanne, I couldn't put this book down. I read it till the wee hours of the morning, although there were some parts maybe be better not to read in the middle of the night, but... And we know that one of the challenges tonight is to not do any spoiler, not give too much away. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Bloodmark? Maybe where did the idea come from? And what is And that book cover. Oh, you guys, didn't you just love that?
That book cover is phenomenal.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the book and maybe what Bloodmark means. And then we would love to know a little backstory on the title, on the cover.
Oh, sure. Well, the idea for the story came to me in fits and starts, kind of like a patchwork quilt, not like the other stories that I've written. So this one's been coming at me for a long, long time. And to describe it, it's a supernatural thriller, and it tells the story of a woman named Jane Walker, who is a woman who was born with three strikes against her. First of all, she was abandoned at birth. She bears blood red birthmarks that snake around her body, and she suffers from these debilitating nightmares. But she meets a fierce friend in the group homes growing up by the name of Sadie Prescott, who is a hooker on the side. So she's an interesting character. And they grow up together and work their way out of the downtown rooming house and into a half-decent apartment. And then Jane meets a man who sees past her birthmarks, the first time it's ever happened to her. And best of all, her birthmarks mysteriously start to disappear. And she is absolutely thrilled about that. That is, until she learns that a killer is stalking her and her marks are the only things keeping her alive.
Oh, my gosh. It's a really good synopsis. Gentlemen, you can jump in here at any time. Jim,
going to.
Jump in.
First of all, when we talked the other night, my comment to you was that we like to be able to get behind the author and how they put together and how they assimilate with the story they've given us. Phenomenal. Your writing is so good. And the last book we read of yours was so good. Although I was a little disappointed, not as much sex in this one, but hey.
But I have to say,
the one scene that really grabbed my attention more than anything in this book, it's almost a throwaway scene, is when she's notices that the design on the chinaware is her birthmark. And I'm not going to go further than that. It's just that is such a wonderful scene that is written, and it's under the radar, but it's really not.
Yeah.
Because it's really something, but you don't know what yet.
Yeah, yeah. I like to keep that going for as long as possible, and then kind of pull a rug out a little later on for the readers on that particular piece, but. This was such fun to write this book, and I'm so pleased that you guys all like it. And I'm going to take that because I know that is, you guys are writers, you're publishers, and I'm taking that compliment and putting it in my back pocket and pulling it out when I get my first one star.
It won't come from us.
If you get a one star for this one, give me the name of the person who gives it to you. I'll have a word with them.
And Richard's known for doing that.
Yes.
We'll send Ethan out on him. The characters in this book are really wonderful, and I enjoyed so many of them, from major characters like Jane to more minor characters that we learn play a really important role, like Buddy. Do you want to just maybe touch on one or two that you particularly enjoyed writing or were challenging to write?
Yes. I was very cautious and careful with Buddy, for example. I wanted him to be someone that was not pitying. I didn't want people to pity him. I wanted people to think that he was a very kind young man that is doing his very best to make good of a very unfortunate situation for himself. And Buddy's coming back. Just want you to know. That's a little teaser. He's coming back. Because I'm working on the next book right now, and I'm having such fun. The other character I loved writing was Sadie. As a matter of fact, there was a point when I thought, oh my gosh, I think maybe Sadie is outshining Jane, which, you know, I didn't want that to happen. But Sadie was a hoot, you know, that she's crust, you know, always a mess, disheveled. She's beautiful, but she's, you know, picking at her teeth and crusty spots on her shirt. And she's a hooker on the side, and she's a little bit obstinate and stubborn, and she's a perfect opposite to Jane.
Absolutely. And she can rumba. Which incidentally is the shortest chapter I have ever read in a book in my life.
Yeah.
One paragraph.
Yeah.
Well, there's a real special connection with between Jane and Sadie, and you introduced that right on. Jane actually has a number of different names. I thought that was interesting too. They have more than one name. And I thought that was very intriguing. And that is a really special bond between those two gals. How did they meet? And did they just take on lives of their own as you were writing? Or did you sort of know who they were going to be?
No, I knew who Jane was going to be. I knew her right away. Sadie, I was looking for somebody who would be a good person for her to live with. So I needed there to be some tension between the two of them, but also a really, really strong bond. And so the names for Jane came about quite organically. I always thought of her as Jane, but I thought I wanted to give her the name Jane because it's based on baby Jane Doe. That was her first name that she was when she was abandoned. That's what the police and the hospital will call a baby when they're abandoned. And then somebody will give them a name usually. And so the woman who was a nurse at the hospital named her Joyce. And so she grew up as Joyce Walker because she was adopted by the Walkers. She grew up as Joyce Walker, and she didn't realize until she was old enough to get her records that she was named after the train station where she was abandoned, right. Which is really sad. So she obviously, prefers Jane because that was her original name. And then she suffers from a sleep condition. And so mm-hmm. her very good girlfriend, Sadie, who she met at the group home. So she knew her way back when they were growing up. She calls her Narc, but it's not Narc as in cop Narc. It's Narc for narcoleptic.
Narcolepsy.
Yeah, narcolepsy. So yeah, she has three. And the editor actually questioned me. She said, "Are you sure you want this character to have three names?" But I thought each of those three names were appropriate and good, and gave her some depth, and gave the two of them some depth together, because mm-hmm. Sadie never calls her Narc in public, only mm-hmm. ever when she's drunk in public. Mm-hmm. Or
mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I think we all have different names that people call us by. I mean, that made it a very natural thing for you to have her having Joyce and Jane, and then the nickname Narc. And I'm sitting here thinking, if you go through all my family and friends, I've got about seven or eight. So, that I think is just a natural part of everybody. And I think that just made them more realistic as characters.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think when we discussed The Secret Sky back in April, I think we put together your wit and your storytelling abilities into the book, The Secret Sky, which was incidentally part of a 7 book series.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
This one is not. It's a separate standalone.
It is. But they all start off that way. And then
sure. Sure. But your ability to assimilate characters and to make them believable and real really astonishes me because, Richard and I are both writers. We do our very damnedest to get, our characters believable. And we do that through dialogue. And we do it through backgrounds, and we do it, in several tricks that we use. Apparently you had the same teacher we did, because you almost do the same thing, which is really nice to see. Your books read like our books read very quickly, and you can't stop reading them once you get into them, because they are so interesting and they are so fun.
They're so filled with detail. Like you were talking a minute ago, Jim, about a scene that really, you called it maybe a throwaway scene. But as a reader, when we get in, you give us a lot of clues. And then I think I kind of begin looking for them, like Highland Breeders, without getting into any kind of a spoiler alert. But it's kind of mentioned, early in the book. And I thought to myself, you know what? That's going to come back. What else is she planting that's going to come back?
Yeah, it's like you plant a lot of Easter eggs.
Yes.
And, you follow the bunny along the trail. And sometimes you backtrack, sometimes you don't. But at the end, I sat there at the end of this book and I went, which was just this afternoon, and I thought, holy crap, it all fit. You know, it all fit. It took a while, but it all fit.
Yeah.
But it's not anything that's an immediate amazement. You have to think about it for a minute. And I think we all came to that conclusion. We have to think about the ending for just a little bit before we really, really get it.
Well, and I began to have some questions afterwards. I thought, you know, like in the day or so after, and I thought, wait a minute. That's when you know it's a great book, because you don't stop thinking about it. And so this afternoon, Joanne and I went back and I read the first, I don't know, 120 pages or something. And it was like, oh, how did I miss that? Oh.
I love that you did that. I just love it. That's exactly what I want. I want people to find those little things that I took in that you don't know are big things until the end.
I'm going to tiptoe along the spoiler line here and try not to fall over. But when I'm reading as a writer, I find myself kind of trying to figure out where the writer of the book I'm reading is going. And I love it when a writer throws me a curveball that I wasn't looking for and they go off in a direction I didn't expect. And you did this because this is an urban fantasy book, but it's also a time travel story. And that's as far as I'll go on spoilers. But that aspect of it, that's where when I realized this aspect of the story was presenting itself and what it was going to, where it was going to lead, I really got excited about reading the rest of this book, because I love time travel stories anyway. But it was so lightly brought in and perfectly done that you didn't realize it until you're about 10, 15 pages in. You're like, wait a minute, wait, where are we going? So when I encounter a writer who does that, because I love doing it with mine, I mean, it just makes me want to read more of their books, because if you can do that subtly, that's just, you know, I want to see what else you can do. So that aspect of this book was great. I'm glad you went that way with this, even though I thought you were going a different direction. I love the way you went with it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. That was a surprise to me as much as you, because originally I was not thinking that it would go to the extent that it did. And again, dancing along that mm-hmm. line, I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. And I did want it to have a massive effect on her. I think I cheat that.
Yeah. Well, we talked to writer Roy Griffiths last week, and his book was totally crazy. It was like, one of those kind of books that if you don't get it, you're not going to get it. But one thing about his book, and Richard brought this up, was that it had a lot of H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, yeah.
In it. And you know what? Amazingly enough, this book does too.
Oh.
It's got a lot of, it's got not a lot, but it's got some Lovecraftian stuff in it. When it comes to, well, I hesitate to say supernatural, but okay, supernatural. But it's also got some. It's also got a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe, which I really like.
Little Inca myth going on in there,
right?
And some things because it happens pretty early in the book, like one of those marks suddenly disappeared. Right. The hair went up on my arms when that first mark disappeared. I was like, what? And I had to go back and reread. I was like, what? Because you tell us from the very beginning, Jane would really like to get these removed. It's a goal that she, you know, she has. And I thought, okay, where's this taking us? I noticed that there are some some themes that run through the book. One of them maybe is what's beauty?
Absolutely. Yep. And beauty equals good. Like the whole concept of the things you get away with if you're beautiful versus the things that you get denied if you're not beautiful, the labels we attach to beautiful people and the privilege that they are given. And I made a very, very specific point of making sure that Cynthia in this story, who is the madam, that she is always absolutely pristine. She's in crisp, cool whites and creamy winter whites, always hair perfectly done and put together absolutely perfectly. And I thought that I wanted to do that on purpose because I wanted it to be something that you think about. I'm glad, Bobby, that you actually you thought of that, because mm-hmm. that is something mm-hmm. I was thinking about during.
Yeah, when I first met Cynthia in this book, and you know, in her description, the first thing that popped into my brain, and forgive me, but it's an old reference. Welcome to Fantasy Island. And that's almost what it was.
Regarding Cynthia, my great grandfather was one of the the guys with the bent nose and the flower and the lapel mafiosos. I got to say, I really approve of her solution to the problem.
Oh, yeah.
So, and again, spoilers, I can't tell you what and who and why, but that was, I liked the way she worked that out. That was well done.
Good.
Well, another... suffice to say, this book is so well written. It amazes me that you can come up with such quality time after time after time. And my hat's off to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's wonderful to hear.
You're welcome.
Another theme that runs through probably almost every character is family, mm-hmm. and different definitions of family, different organizations of family, family you choose, like Sadie and Jane kind of being family. And you give us lots of different views. I really liked the Baker family that run Positively Plants. And I was kind of like, I wonder why she chose a plant nursery for Jane to be Jane's employer. And then the folks that run that really have, our family, yeah. consider her family. And I think she considers it. So there's a lot of different families. You want to talk a little bit about the family theme?
Sure. And the family theme, again, was another one that I was quite consciously figuring out and talking about and putting in as many different variations as I could. And especially the Positively Plant family, they're so close, the brother and sister that run the nursery. And the reason that I picked a nursery, I actually originally was going to make her a bicycle courier, because downtown Vancouver is full of bicycle couriers. But I know that out on your face, you probably wouldn't want to be meeting the public very, very much. And I had a girlfriend who worked in a nursery for a period of time, and she was telling me about the watering routines and how, that's a long monotonous chore, but it has to be done every day, and you can kind of hide out when you're doing that chore. And I figured she needed to be working in a place where she could hide and cover her face and be away from the public. So I didn't think the bicycle courier was a good choice. So that's how she ended up with Positively Plants. And I love the idea that her and Sadie are fierce friends. They're not just, good friends. They're actually, they have fought fights together, knife fights and fist fights. They grew up rough on the streets. And I like the idea that those two cannot be torn apart.
Yeah. So. Another theme is strength and vulnerability.
Yeah, and this is something that I do for all of my characters, the main characters. It's a conscious choice that the woman who is the lead will not be rescued by someone else. She will rescue herself, and she will be strong. And if she can't be physically strong, she'll be strong some other way. In The Gift Legacy, Emmeline is not a big woman, but she is strong. She doesn't know her strength until later in the book, but she comes up with some pretty powerful ways to be strong. And same with Jane in this one. She is a fighter, so she knows how to fight and use a knife, and she's not afraid to use a knife, and she uses it for good things.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I know you got something important to share. Jump in here.
Okay, well, I was going to follow up on Jane, because the point you're bringing up is she knows how to fight, but you did a very good job of establishing this long term buildup to being a skilled fighter, being able to defend herself, working out. You don't just magically one day she wakes up and, hey, I can outfight people with a knife and kick them and all this. So I like the way that you did that, because in science fiction, as a science fiction writer, the one thing that drives us crazy is it's called the Mary Sue, where she's just going along doing her thing, and all of a sudden she has all these powers. Okay, you didn't establish anything. So when I was reading this, I'm like, yes, you've established why she's able to do all these things at the end of the book, because she has a lifetime of working at this. So it's believable. And again, it falls to the you created believable characters. And I think that's something that a lot of writers don't understand, is you have to make your characters believable. And it sounds like that's something when you approach building your characters, that's what you're doing. You want to do that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I remember writing a line, first we learn to fight and then we learn to fight smart. And a lot of that is from, you know, watching the videos of people training how to, like I had to do a lot of research on the fighting that she did in this. So I would know how to execute certain moves that she makes. And it's in those videos that you say, yeah, you can fight or you can fight smart. And if you fight, you're not going to be necessarily fighting smart. Smart fighters, you know, get out of the box quicker and with less damage.
Right.
Fall into it, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, at least in, especially in the case of this book, I mean, you made sure the reader knew that this is just not somebody just going to go out there and throw haymakers and all of a sudden she's wiping out people two or three times bigger than she is. There's a reason why she's able to take these guys down. And it is very believable. And again, that's something that I don't want to say I harp on, but it's something that will hang me up in a book. And it does it for any character. If it's some guy who's just, you know, works on a computer all day and all of a sudden he can go out and take on an invading army. And no, that's, you know, it completely ruins it. So I'm glad you were able to do that.
Great. Thanks. Yeah, I make when I'm doing those kinds of things, the biggest challenge for me is getting that information in a way that doesn't distract the reader. So finding the opportunities to plug that information in, because it doesn't start when they're kids. It starts when she's an adult rescuing Sadie from a bar.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's all these little crumbs that you leave along the trail for us to follow and get to where, you know, not only where we need to be, but in a believable way. So we'll continue on. Otherwise, I've seen so many books that I've read where a chapter in, I'm like, no, you know, where are you getting this? So, researching is, and it kind of leads to my next question, is you bring up some Inca lore. How much time did you have to spend digging into that to get all that out to make it work? Because I know I've done some and I've recognized a lot of what you were talking about, but I know that's just not something you Google real quick and, you know, throw together. So how much time did you take researching that?
Oh, I researched that for hours and hours. What I found interesting is when you Google Inca culture, almost every single site will have the same photographs.
I've noticed that too.
Yeah, so people are familiar with the tiered green lush hillside. They're familiar with those. So when you mention them, people say, "Oh yeah, I know that. I recognize that." And
Or you get links to videos of ancient aliens, one or the other, you know?
Well, it's like all the research you do on historical stuff. You usually get the same pictures, you know, and a lot of the time it's the same verbiage, you know, because it's depending on what's available. It's like if you talk about an old West town, you usually get like Deadwood, Dodge City, and Tombstone. That's the three that you normally get a lot of. Mm-hmm. So that's everybody's vision of an old West town, but hardly any of them look that way. Right. So, you know, hey, we're going to take we can take a real short break. Right now we'd like to run, this is LA Talk Radio and we are, of course, the Writer's Block. And we'll be right back after this real brief message from Creative Edge Publicity. At Creative Edge, we are a team and a community, says Mickey Mickelson, owner of Creative Edge Publicity. The entire organization believes strongly in collaboration from the authors
to myself and down to key partnerships we've developed. Mickey is passionate about working in conjunction with his clients and finding more innovative and creative ways to ensure that each represented client has a promotional and marketing success, be it podcasts, TV, or live radio interviews. Creative Edge Publicity is your edge in getting your work known. Go to www.creativeedgepublicity.com or write to Mickey at mickey@creativeedgepublicity.com. It's your future and your work. Don't trust it to an amateur. Creative Edge, your key to success.
And we are back in the studio. Of course, we have Miss Lead Person tonight, Bobby Jean Bell, and of course, Richard Paulinelli. And our guest tonight is J.P. McLean from a little tiny island off of Vancouver, B.C., eh?
Yes.
let me get off of the book for a moment. Where did this idea come from? I mean, it had to been, you know, fomenting in your brain for a while. And the second part of this same question is, when you're developing a book or a story, do you outline or are you a pantser?
Okay. The first part of that story is answer is yes. It came to me quite a while ago, actually, the initial idea. And what spurred that initial idea was, if you might remember the opening scene of a series called Blind Spot, where a woman gets she's dropped in the Times Square in a duffel bag, and the bomb guy is opening up the zipper, and then this woman pops out, and she's absolutely tattooed from her neck down.
Right, and so butt naked.
That scene stayed with me for a very long time, and I found it quite intriguing. So that was certainly part of it. The other part of the patchwork quilt was, you know, when you have a dream that is so darn real, you wake up from it, and for a few seconds, you are emotionally attached to it still. You're angry, you're upset, you're happy. There's an emotion attached to that. And you wake up with that emotion stuck to your head. And I thought to myself, wow, like that. So that was another part of it. And I wove that into this because Jane's dreams are like this. They're more extreme than that. But she has those, you know, emotional attachment to those dreams. And the third one is the time slip idea, because I really liked the damage that could be wrought if you go back in time and change one tiny, tiny thing. Like, I can't imagine, you know, if a bullet jammed in a gun and people who were, you know, Kennedy or Martin Luther King or somebody did die, like what a huge change that would have made in the world. So I love that idea. And so all those ideas kind of came, like I said, it was a patchwork quilt, this one. It didn't come smoothly. And so I mushed all those ideas up. And in terms of am I a pantster or a liner, I did the first book pantsing, and I probably did the first two or three with a higher quantity of pantsing than planning. I pretty much now plan it fairly well. I've got the beginning, the end. I've got probably four or five key scenes in the middle, and I have an overarching arc that will take it through the series. So I kind of know where it's going. As I'm writing it, though, I will not let my outline dictate the creative process. If I can, I guess so. I'm going to stick to my plan.
Have you allowed your characters to dictate which direction your story is going to go?
Yeah, sometimes, for sure. Yeah. Like the scene where Jane is in the professor's office and has to make a decision. That scene took a while to figure out, because I knew where I wanted her to go, but it wasn't an automatic that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So yeah, mm-hmm. she made that decision based on all the stuff she'd been through. She made that decision.
Okay.
You have a particular character that's really nasty, and this character has been planning his nastiness for a long time. What was it like to write this character and evolve him? I mean, tell us a little bit about writing the bad guy.
Yeah, writing the bad guy. It's kind of hard with this one because I don't want to give too much away. But
I know.
It's difficult to talk about him. He's psychotic. He is a narcissistic personality type, and he loves himself an awful lot. And I think if I get any comments from people at the end of this, it's concerning the extreme level of his deceptiveness, I suppose. And I think he is the I'm trying to put it into words, but don't spoil the
end. Don't spoil.
Yeah. It was hard to write him because I wanted there to be some quality to him that was not awful, like one or two redeeming qualities. So again, family, and it goes back to family, and it's what he perceives his family is not what his family is, but because he's mentally ill, he perceives them in a way that they're not like that. That's just his perception of them. But there's no other way to get the other side of that family into that story because it's only his perspective, right? So you're only hearing his perspective. But I suspect in the next book we might hear about the other perspective.
Mm. How do you get into your characters' heads? How do you do that?
I guess I try to put myself in their boots. Like I really do try to think about how you would react if that was your life, if that was your perspective. And I've lived in downtown Vancouver, so I know, you know, how harsh it is for some people living on the street. So you kind of try to put yourself in that perspective and in that position. So, and when I'm coming to a scene, I actually, you know, have the camera on my shoulder and I'm that character as I'm in that scene. So I can, I just seem to be able to do that for some reason, thankfully. Touch wood. Keep going.
I'm looking at the clock and we need to ask the question. Gentlemen, which one of you is going to ask the question tonight?
Oh, I'll jump in and I'll take this one. Okay. So the question is, do you ever suffer from that malediction we know as writer's block? And if you do, what Inca spell do you summon to chase it off to where it belongs?
Oh, dear. You know, I don't often suffer from that. But when I do, I have my trusty garden full of weeds outside that I can go and attack. And I got to tell you, when the first 6 months or so of this pandemic hit, I was suffering. I was finding it really difficult to be creative during that time. And I probably put it off for about 6 months. I could sit down and do little snippets, but I could not really write very well. So thank God for the garden and the weeds that grow in it that give me something to attack and walks. I go for walks. So on my Instagram feed, you see pictures of what I walk by, and it's pretty. So there's ocean scenes and, you know, so that's what I do. I walk, I pull weeds, and that's it. Drink wine.
And drink wine.
And drink wine.
Yeah. And drink wine. Always a good thing. Real quick, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you wake up from a dream and it's vivid for you. And the comment that I would have to that is I actually had a dream and it was the whole book. And I kept that dream. It never left me. The whole story was in my brain and never, never stopped. So I do have a book, Jonah Blue, that is start to finish all the way through.
One dream. Wow. Dreams are powerful. They're really powerful.
They are. And they can, you live in a very powerful area. You must live in an apex of supernatural and witchcraft. And because I know we discussed this before, Vancouver Island is one of the harbingers of witchcraft. I mean, it's everywhere in downtown Victoria.
On this island, we have a huge writing community. And as I say, you know, you can't swing a cat without hitting a writer. So a lot of that would be in the live cat enjoying the swing, by the way. not a cat of nine tails.
Which would actually going to be in the next book, right?
Yes.
The cat of nine tails.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt sorry, Bobby, because you missed the great sex scenes in Secret Sky, and I heard from Jim and Richard Bobby should have been here because she was.
Yeah, she would have handled that show better.
You would have seen her turn beet red.
I told you.
I live for reading those scenes.
Actually, she's gotten pretty good at reading them. She's still not very good about talking about them. She's pretty good at reading them.
Oh yeah, this was much more toned down. It really was.
Not surprisingly, but I mean, some books just, you know, require it, and some don't.
Yeah, this one didn't. Yeah, I figured if I was going to tone it up at all, it would be the hooker. And I didn't want to do those things.
Yeah. Probably not. Yeah.
Yeah, that might have made it a rated X book if you had gone that direction. So we're glad you did.
For sure. Well, I don't know how much time we've got left. Let me check with Sam and see.
Yeah, because we're at the hour and 49 minutes. We're fast running out of time.
I say we get the extra 7 minutes we didn't get to start the show.
Here we go. I just got an answer. Okay, we got to wrap it up. So,
okay. All right.
Bobby, you going to wrap it up?
So where can people follow you and get the book?
They can follow me on my website, which is jpmclainauthor.com, and the book will be available wide come Tuesday next week, and it's on pre-order right now. You can get a link through Amazon or Kobo or from my website.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
We thank you for being with us. Our guest next week is Anderson Harp with a new Will Parker thriller, November 400 CP is Missing. And I have one parting thought to our author friends. Keep writing, and we'll keep publishing and reading and talking about what you write. And as our fearless host, Jim Christina, always ends the show with what, Jim?
Well, I want to thank Bobby Jean Bell, Richard Polinelli, our guest tonight, Miss J.P. McLean, Sam Hassan, my real good buddy, the bookie herself, Jerry Christina, and for all of us, at LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.